The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
As I said to you all, we do have a special interview for you at this point in time. Joining us, a gentleman, he's been with us on several occasions before discussing some of the issues. He joins us again this morning. Let's welcome to our program to speak to us about some of the issues confronting us. Businessman Gregory Abood, representing DOMA. Good morning to you, and welcome back to our program here this morning. Good morning to you, and welcome back to our program. It's nice to have you here this morning. There are some issues that have been lingering for some time with the port, and you've issued some statements suggesting that this thing could be more disastrous to the business and economy than people may understand on the face of it. For those who may have missed that press release and some of the issues that you raised, let's start our discussion there. The disruptions at the port and the impact it's having on business and the potential impact it could have. Tell us about those.
Well, I mean, since issuing the notice that we did regarding the situation of disruption at the port of Port of Spain, the situation has normalized, and the port operations have caught up to the backlog that existed. So to some extent, the concerns expressed have been addressed. What I can also say to you is that there's really, in my respectful view, no real need to labor the point or the points made in the release, because it should be basic common sense, which sometimes, unfortunately, in Trinidad and Tobago is not so common, that if you disrupt the operations of a vital service such as port entry and export, that you're going to severely affect the efficiency and the efficiency of the productive capacity of the country and all that. Mm. And therefore, making a point about port disruptions and complaining about its effect is pretty straightforward. And so straightforward is it that, you know, in many societies, disrupting the port or interrupting the work that is done in ports of entry in a lot of societies, in a lot of countries very close to Trinidad, is forbidden. You can't do it. And it's considered an essential service, a vital service. And so anyway, but we're over that now, hopefully, for a while. And we're not going to see any of that. And we could try and keep the Trinidad and Tobago economy moving forward.
Yeah, somebody just sent a message, you know, the services at the port now are good. And that they're satisfied. It's probably somebody who uses the port for business for one reason or the other.
Of course.
The it's great news to hear that, well, things are working the way they should.
Again.
But yeah, there's always the possibility that this thing could fall down with the union not getting something or something falling apart. You're bringing into the discussion making this an essential service, an interesting perspective. Is that something that DOMA believes should be actively considered and enforced or implemented?
Well, I think that it's fair to say, after all these years, that, you know, the port hasn't been the greatest problem that the country faces.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is true that it should be designated an essential service. I'm not sure it isn't, but you know, I think things are pretty normalized on the port at the moment. We don't have a persistent history of disruptions at the port by the port authority or the operators of the port. We have other issues to deal with at the port, which include clearance of cargo and so on. But I'm sure that it should be attracting the attention of the government in trying to make the port an essential service, if it is not already so. But I don't think it's as pressing an issue to those in authority at this time, because I believe that they think correctly, actually, that that they have it under control.
What are some of the issues that you think should be high on the agenda?
Well, I think that what has happened, unfortunately, with the state of decay in law and order is that we are more or less communicating to the citizens that the country is out of control. I do believe that it's fair comment to say that what is said publicly in the pages of all the newspapers and in all the television and radio station interviews that occur with so many of the, you know, major authorities and all the members of parliament and government ministers and so on, what is portrayed in all of those interviews is not, unfortunately, what is being felt by the citizens of the country. I think that for those who live and work on the ground, which I like to credit myself with doing, that rub shoulders on the street with the average citizen and that walk around and exchange views and see the mood of the people and so on, I think that people have resigned themselves to the fact that the country is spiraling out of control. You can't defend your authority and have people killing four men in a camp in Mayaro and telling us that the matter is under investigation by this squad and that squad. And then at the same time that you're saying that, there is a murder in Kokorit in which the newspaper is reporting plainly that spent shells with the markings of the TTPS were found at the scene of the crime. And you can't assume that the average citizen has respect for authority anymore. And I'm not talking about criminal citizens. I'm talking about law-abiding citizens of the country would be well within their right to have no respect for authority at this time, because you want to enforce traffic laws and give me tickets because my tent is not good or my tent is too dark. But people are free to go around shooting and killing two and three and four at a time, and no one is brought to justice. And all sorts of comments are made publicly by people in high office, and nothing can be believed anymore because of what we are witnessing, what we are seeing. The murder rate has caught up to last year's record rate, which is a shame and a sadness. And a number of crimes are being reported which are outrageous in nature and which citizens obviously are justified in feeling that they will never be solved or will not be solved. And it's just really, in my opinion, the number one issue right now, is to get back in control of the country for the government to retake control of Trinidad and Tobago and to not pretend that they are in control, but to recognize and be truthful to themselves that they are not in control and that the situation is spiraling out of control. I think this, to me, is job number one. I'm not saying that we don't have serious problems to deal with in health and education and infrastructure and all the rest of it. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that, you know, if a referee loses control of the game, it doesn't matter who's scoring goals and which team wins and so on. What matters is that he's lost control of the game and all sorts of infractions can take place on the field of play, including all sorts of, you know, atrocious play and attacks on each other and so on. And if the referee loses control of the game, there is no game. And I'm very worried that we are communicating a lack of control in Trinidad and Tobago. People want to say, well, it's worse in Jamaica. I don't think it is worse in Jamaica. I think the government in Jamaica is more firmly in control and exercises that control. Yes, they have a serious underclass of persons who are suffering and taking matters into their own hand and trying to earn respect with a gun and so on. Yes, they have that problem, but we have it too. But we have other problems in Trinidad and Tobago in my humble view, that I can't speak to about in Jamaica, I could speak to here. Mm-hmm. And we still have a case where men escaped from a jail many years ago and killed a police officer, and they had guns and grenades in their possession when they escaped from the case. And we have no resolution to that. What we have is a number of murdered prison officers. We can't explain why they were murdered, but we could put two and two together and maybe come up with a number that could explain something to us and to the country. These are not matters to be hidden away. This is serious, serious decay within the structure of the Trinidad and Tobago society, and it's affecting the average citizen. So much has been said about the poor man and the social safety net, and so many people are falling through the net, you know, and so much lip service has been paid to all these issues and nothing is happening. Mm-hmm. So this is my view about what is really pressing at the moment. Mm-hmm. In Trinidad and Tobago, that we need to realize that what matters most is that we be truthful with ourselves, that we tell the truth to ourselves first and then to the country, that we are in a grave situation in which the murder rate has caught up to last year's rate, and in which we have to find strategic solutions quickly. Short-term solutions and long-term solutions. I mean,
but Mr. Abud, you've been talking about this for a long period of time, and you've been highlighting the seriousness, the gravity of the situation in all the pronouncements that you make. But the country has found itself in a position where the persons who occupy high office don't seem to want the situation to change. And the reason why I say that is, we had our president making a pronouncement that they should meet and they should talk. And then one side saying, all right, no problem, let's do this. The other side saying, no, well, I don't want to do this, I want to do that. And it has descended into us versus them. And there's a saying that while the elephants fight, it's the grass that gets trampled. And the citizens of this country continue to be affected by crime in very serious ways. People have curtailed what they do, self-imposed curfews. You have businesses that no longer operate at the hours that they used to. I mean, I went to Curep Junction recently, and I was this may seem insignificant, but it's an indicator how things have changed. And I was talking to the oyster man, and I was asking him, I said, well, partner here, now, what time you sell until? And he say he does not sell until after 7 because Curep has become so dangerous. And even selling to 7 o'clock now is a real, real gamble for him. And there are businesses across the country who have adopted similar. You have people who don't go anywhere again. Family gatherings have all been curtailed. And the effects, you see them. People living in their own prisons now with the burglar proofing and so on. And yet still, those in authority, and I use that term broadly, can't seem to get their act together. So these issues that need to be addressed, who is going to address them if the people who on the face of it should be addressing them are not addressing them?
Well, excuse me. I would like to say quickly, in response to the first point you made about those in authority not wanting it to change, that I disagree with that statement. I don't think there's anybody in government that is happy about what is happening in the country. I just don't think that they know what should be done. And they certainly don't want any advice from anybody who could help to explain what should be done and how to organize, you know, a protective services division and a modern society to make it safe for people who are the productive element of the society. Because don't forget that everything you were talking about there comes from the productive side of the society. Mm. These are people who are producing, paying taxes, earning an income to feed their families and so on. I don't think the government is happy about what it is that is taking place. But I think it's fair to say that they haven't taken ownership of it in the way that they should, because they don't know what to do. Here it is, you have pronouncements being made by those in authority that crime is a whole of society problem, in which you are saying to the citizens of the country, you have a responsibility and crime is a whole of society problem. What about saying crime is a whole of government problem? How about saying that? How about saying that crime is not the only problem, only the problem of the Minister of National Security or of the Prime Minister, because it is only the Prime Minister and the Minister of National Security that get forced out under the lights to defend the government and to defend the country against this chaos that is taking place. Not a single member of the government, not one member of parliament, not one of them has ever come out and made a pronouncement about crime, because it is not their ministry, they say. But it's their constituency. It's their constituency because they took an oath to represent the people that elected them. And do any of those members of parliament or any of those ministers or any of those persons who, you know, enjoy all the perks of this public life, so to speak, do any of them even know how many police stations are in their constituency? Do they even know who is the sergeant and the inspector in each of those stations? Do they know that? Have they ever visited the police station to ask if they could be of any assistance to the police in that station in their constituency? What is it that they know about assisting in the improvement of the protection of their constituents in their constituency that elected them to sit in the parliament? This is a very important question that I would like to ask publicly. If crime is a whole of society problem, what about all of the members of parliament? Are they making any contribution to assisting in the resolution of law and order? And have they ever visited a police station in their constituency, is my point. Have they ever done that? So that's my response to that. Now, on the question of the requested by Her Excellency, the President of the government and opposition, I don't know, but, you know, I said earlier that common sense is not so common. I am confused about us wanting people who are designated to oppose each other, working together to help solve any problem. Because the model as it exists is not a correct governance model. In that you are calling the members of the current party that sits across from the government, you are designating them and calling them the opposition. That's what they are called in this governance model. They're called opposition members, members of the opposition. What is it that you want them to do? Not oppose? That's what they do. That's what you said they do. That's what we call them. And you are asking them to come together with the government to give the government ideas about how to make the country safer, which will make the government look better and more electable. Is that what you want them to do? You want them to help the government to look better and become more electable than they are at the moment. I'm not sure how you expect that to work, but I never had any hope at all, zero hope, that the opposition would get together and help the government to solve crime. And I'm not even sure how the government, other than for optics, expected that to work either. If you know what needs to be done and you are in government, then do what you have to do to make the situation safe for people so that they could send their children to school without being worried that they will be beaten and bullied and come home with concussion by the situation in the schools, or that you could send them down to the corner to make message and buy a loaf of bread and not be shot in the crossfire between two men who want to kill each other because one told the other not to lean on his car, and he leaned on the car and the other one came back for him with a gun. I don't understand. If you don't know what to do about that, what the opposition could do to help you to solve that, and why you would expect anybody that is supposed to be opposing you to give you any advice to help you look better and become more electable. I never had any hope of that. And to be honest, until you change that constitutional model, which is a big subject, and which I would like to congratulate the government for appointing a committee at least to look at it, at the review of the Constitution, on which I would like to take this opportunity in these few remaining minutes to say to the public that they should avail themselves of this opportunity. Go to the website, constitutionalreform2024.gov.tt. Go to the website, read our current constitution, and then make suggestions to the committee about the changes that you want to see. Because to be honest, asking the government and the opposition to meet to find solutions to crime, I mean, this is like kindergarten nursery rhyme stuff. I don't know what that is supposed to do for the country or how that's supposed to help us to ask people who are designated to oppose each other by the model that we put in place in 1962, how that is supposed to work. I don't get it. It could be rewritten to follow a more Republican model, in my view, a model of a republic that recognizes the selfish nature of man and that designates performance and merit in every aspect of what we do. And that would help us without having to pretend, you know, that a party which is called an opposition, you refer to them as opposition, but you don't want them to be opposing anything. You just want them to be supportive. I just don't get it. And it has to be improved. It has to be changed. And so that is my view of that with respect to the comments you made about the government and those in authority.
We have just a couple of minutes again for the interview before we wrap, but I want to get from you, what's happening in the nation's capital? Because we are seeing some crimes being committed, and what's going on with business? Because we were told as well that after COVID, a number of businesses, they close their doors and they move out, and we are seeing some crimes taking place and murders, as has been going on for quite some time. Is business in Port of Spain heading up, heading down? Is it stagnant? What's going on?
You know, the city of Port of Spain is challenged by its management. The people that manage the city and make decisions don't really belong to the city, so to speak. They don't visit the city. Their families and their wives don't shop in the city. It's a complicated situation that is prevalent everywhere. I know that changes are being made in San Fernando, and the business people there are speaking very positively about what is happening in San Fernando. Port of Spain doesn't have as much good news to report, unfortunately, because I don't know if the business community is seen as a scapegoat or a punching bag, or if it is that the people in authority feel, well, you know, the business people have prospered enough and it's time for them to go. I can't see what explains, you know, the mindlessness of the decision makers, except that we have to fight all the time to try and impose policies or get policies for Port of Spain. I think that generally the business community, more or less, like the citizens, in the way that the citizens have resigned themselves to the fear that they are living with, or the citizens have sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, but what can we do? I think the business community also has a pretty lukewarm view of the way things are going in the country, and investment is not what it should be. Investment confidence is not what it should be. Persons are nervous about what could happen or what might happen, and the way that the country is being managed. Certainly, national security sends a terrible message. You know, it's just a very bad message to send. It overpowers every other positive sign or every other glimmer of hope that we have if we're not safe. People don't like to go to places that are not safe. People don't want to come to Trinidad for the reputation that we have. Investment by foreigners is not going to occur if investment confidence by locals is weak. You know, these are all basic common sense factors which I'm mentioning to you. The business community, I think, sort of recognizes that we are in a bit of a tough situation and that, you know, we are not being consulted meaningfully and that our ideas are viewed with suspicion by those in authority. I think it is fair to say that politicians in office look at the business community when they make recommendations and say, what is wrong with these people? They could never win, you know, a seat in parliament. They could never win a seat in an election. They want to tell us how to run the country, and they don't know what needs to be done for us to get into office. They don't know why we make the decisions we make so that we could be reelected. They're only studying how to expand business and make business more efficient. I think that is a fair assessment of what happens when we go to those meetings. And by the same token, I think that the business community murmurs under their breath that they're dealing with people in government that they could never hire to run any aspect of their business. And these people are running all of the country. I mean, you have business people that have quietly murmured, you know, they don't understand how you're giving people like, you know, some people a budget of $2 billion. And you as a businessman couldn't hire them to run a division of your business for $100,000 or $2 million. But they're running a ministry with a budget of $2 and $3 billion. These are the sorts of cynicisms and innuendos that have made it difficult for there to be synergy between the government of the day and the business community. Because this is not peculiar to today's government. This has existed before, in which politicians are suspicious of the advice and the suggestions. I might want to say that there might be one or two exceptions to that. I might want to say that Mr. Pandey was a little different to that. Mr. Pandey was very open to suggestions and advice and implemented a lot of it. And to some extent, Mr. Manning as well. Mr. Manning was a cautious listener, and sometimes he did advice with respect to business policies and so on. But generally speaking, you know, in the past few years, 10 years before this government, the previous government, there's an ambivalence about what is good common sense and good business practice and so on. And that is affecting Port of Spain. It's affecting the whole country, in my opinion.
Yeah. And Mr. Booth, that's we're going to have to leave it this morning because that's all the time that we have.
Of course.
But it is always interesting speaking to you to get an insight into some of these issues that the general public may not necessarily analyze in the manner in which you do, and simplify for them why this should be more important to them and a greater part of the national discussion. So I want to thank you for being with us here this morning. And
well, not only that, I would like to close or end by saying that, you know, to thine own self be true is a doctrine that will be enlightening to everybody, including members of the government and opposition and the parties that all want to vie for control, and that the ultimate objective of trying to improve the quality of life of people, of the citizens of the country, is the doctrine of the Constitution. Look at the Constitution, go to the website, and read the existing Constitution, our present Constitution, make recommendations to the committee, is what I would like to close with. It's your voice, it's your country. The Constitution is supposed to represent you and supposed to make your life better. And don't take a 6 for a 9 with respect to what is being said publicly about the state of law and order in Trinidad and Tobago. Recognize the seriousness of it and agitate for truth and reality with respect to what is being told to us about the state of affairs in Trinidad and Tobago. And thank you very much.
Yeah, definitely great advice. Thank you once again for being with us here this morning.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.